acknowledge Jesus as the Messiah should be banned from the synagogue. And that's why the parents said, "He's of age, ask him." I've always wondered if those parents kept on attending their synagogue, went to the covered dish suppers, enjoyed the friends they had there, and just never talked about their boy again. Did they see their son? Were they able to rejoice with him that his eyes had been opened? We don't know, but I've always wondered. Doing a parent's workshop was at the top of my list of favorite speaking engagements, and it seemed a good idea this time to include friends of our GLBT children. For me, talking to parents is one way I can try to make right something I learned was very wrong at the very beginning of my public ministry more than 20 years ago. It was 1994, and Dr. Ralph Blair had invited me to speak at the Eastern Connection in Pennsylvania. It was the first time I'd ever spoken publicly about anything, so I was nervous. I was especially nervous about the question and answer time that was to follow my talk. For some reason I don't understand now, I imagined being asked all kinds of theological questions I wouldn't be able to answer. So I'll never forget the young man who stood to ask me the first question. I'd noticed him because he had listened very closely to my story about how God had led me not only to appreciate God's gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender children, but to become an advocate for them, especially in the church. "Will you adopt me?" he asked. "My parents don't want me like I am, and I wish you were my mother." There was a little polite laughter from the group, but most of the people in that room weren't laughing inside, and I know I wasn't laughing. In the years since then, I've talked to many parents of God's rainbow children, and I found out that while there is occasionally a mother or father who doesn't seem to love a son or daughter, most parents do love their gay kids desperately. But because society and the church have not told them the truth about who their children are, they're unable to understand, support, or appreciate their kids. And one of the joys of my life over the past 22 years has been to do my best to help parents sweep away the misinformation and do what their hearts and the Holy Spirit have been telling them to do all along, love and accept their kids. Sometimes I find myself in the position of seeming to be giving permission for a parent to unconditionally love a child. And as a mother, I find it hard to understand why anybody has to give people permission to do that. But I didn't go to some of the churches some of those parents have gone to, and I didn't hear what they heard. It isn't enough to love your son and daughter in a closet either. It isn't because every person, young or old, longs for parental affirmation. We all want our parents to say, "That's my kid, and I think my kid's the greatest." The Bible tells us about the voice that was heard when Jesus was baptized. In the words of God, Jesus got affirmation. "This is my beloved son, in whom I am well pleased." That was even necessary for Jesus. God says to us that we're his kids and each one of us is the greatest. God came down and died for us, and each one of us who's experienced the saving grace of Jesus Christ knows the unconditional love of God. And as you know, some of you, we never get so old that we don't crave the affirmation and unconditional love of our earthly parents. My own dear mother's in heaven now. I hope she's talking to Cynthia's mom. But she lived on this earth till her 92nd year. And long after I was old enough to get into the movies for half price, it meant the whole world to me that my very sharp and articulate mother would tell anybody who would listen about my ministry and how proud she was of me. I used to worry about her because she did speak out. One time I went to see her and she greeted me with, "I was so mad. I went to Sunday school last week and they had this terrible poster on the wall of our classroom." Mother went on to describe an anti-gay poster that a TV evangelist had been sending out to raise money. Mother told me what had been on the poster and I asked her, "Did you say anything about it in your class?" "No, I just walked over and took it down and put it in my purse." "Here it is. I thought you might like to see it." I guess when you're in your 90s, you can get away with stuff like that. Then there was a time that one of the younger women, probably about 85, where my mother lived, repeated an anti-gay statement to her. And I still remember mother's reply, "Helen, you're about to have a great-grandchild. What if that child is born and turns out to be gay?" Well, Helen informed my mother that such things did not run in her family, so she could never have gay grandchildren. Mother set her straight about that and gave her quite a little sermon about how she was going to feel if she did have a gay grandchild, and people talked about him or her the way she was talking about gay people. My mom was really neat. And she never even thought about the issue till I got into it, and because she loved me, she listened to me and got where she got, which was a great place. And it has been my experience that sometimes older people are wiser when it comes to understanding a gay grandchild than some parents are about their gay kids. I can't tell you how many times I've had somebody call me up and say, "Well, I'm not going home for Thanksgiving this year, I guess. Since I came out, my father says I can't come home until I wise up and go back to being a straight person." My heart always aches with that, and the hurt of rejection makes it hard for my caller to tell me the story sometimes. But then, not often enough, but sometimes, the young person will say something like, "But you know, my grandma called and said, why don't you come and have Thanksgiving with me? And that son of mine can decide whether he wants to invite both of us or neither of us." I had expected it would be the other way around, that the grandparents would be the ones who found it hardest to accept a grandchild who didn't happen to be straight. But I've come to understand that older people have lived long enough that most of them know the value of relationships, because they're the ones who have loved and lost people now gone from this earth. And many older people are smart enough not to throw away a relationship, even if that relationship isn't exactly as they wish it was. I wish I could tell you about all the neat grandparents I know. You know, when people are young, they seem able to tell themselves that if a relationship is not okay now, you can put it on the shelf, so to speak, and get it down at some future time to see if it's any better or the way you want it. Our grandmothers and grandfathers often seem to know that now might be the only time you have. Now that my own mother lives in heaven, I'd give so much to be able to talk to her again, to ask her some of the things I never got around to asking, or get her advice about something I want to do. And all my wishing cannot bring mother back, but thinking about her makes me much more deliberate about making sure I see my dear brother regularly, keep in touch with my son and daughter, not to mention doing a whole lot more traveling with my husband than I used to. And I believe that the neatest memorial to a person we can't do anything for anymore is to do things for other people, Mary Lou. And you do it, you and Bob. I understand a little better than some of you might think how hard it is to have someone you dearly love who doesn't agree with you on something as important as the issue of homosexuality. Well, I guess most of you know that my husband Tony and I don't agree on some important things when it comes to this issue. But we agree on some things. Both of us agree that a homosexual orientation is not chosen any more than is a heterosexual orientation. And both of us feel strongly that no homosexual person should have to be in the closet to be part of the body of Jesus Christ or any church. We grieve together about the fact that most of the church has done so much to turn away God's rainbow children instead of welcoming them. Both Tony and I continue together to be angry about the lies about gay men and lesbians that are propagated by some church leaders and TV evangelists, because we so clearly see that the result of this is cruel mistreatment and great injustice. We pray together often for the church to repent of its sin and exclusion. We don't want them to repeat it. They repent of it. My husband and I differ on the issue of monogamous, loving sexual relationships between people of the same gender. While both of us believe they should be legally permissible in this pluralistic society of ours, I enthusiastically affirm and celebrate such relationships for Christians, and Tony does not. Tony interprets the first chapter of Romans in the traditional way, while I believe that Paul is referring here to pagan religious practices and sexual orgies. Tony believes the Bible prohibits same-gender sexual relationships, and I certainly do not. More about Romans 1 later. You know, that's not my favorite thing to talk about, my husband's point of view, especially here. But you'll see as I go on how God has used what to me was a very painful difference. I support my husband's right to his beliefs, even as I'm very grateful that he, in the face of severe criticism for doing so, continues to support my right to mine. I haven't had a lot of people call me up and be angry, but a lot of people are angry with Tony because of what I do. I haven't figured that out yet, but I've prayed a lot and God hasn't changed Tony's mind, but God has answered my prayers because Tony and I have a bridge ministry these days. Together we've spoken at denominational gatherings, churches, and many Christian colleges, explaining what we agree about and what we disagree about when it comes to the issue of homosexuality. Last Sunday we had 15 minutes on the PBS channel all over the country. Most of my friends didn't see it because at 11 o'clock on Sunday morning, guess where they are? Because of Tony, I've been able to express my views in places where I would not be invited to speak by myself. So many people have told me how what Tony says about justice and the fact that he still loves and respects me has helped family members and parents who are completely unable to see things as I do, yet. Yet's an important word in my vocabulary. I'm a natural optimist. I don't take any credit for being one, but I'm glad I am. It helps in this ministry. Both of us believe that the most important thing we say is something we do not say in words. We say that it's possible for people to love and respect each other and even do kingdom work together on this earth when they don't agree, even on a very important issue like homosexuality. We say that if we're not getting a divorce or even thinking about getting one, we don't see why families have to be estranged and churches and denominations need to split. You parents won't be surprised that two people in the same house don't agree. Marriage partners know that, and anybody that's raised kids know you spend half your time with your children not agreeing with them about a lot of things. You don't have to have homosexuality as your issue to get into that, I know. I treasure that verse in the Bible at the end of the love chapter, the 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians, about how we all see through a glass darkly. I've always taken that personally to mean that God is telling me it's okay if I don't get it or misunderstand some things. I loved it the other day when David Myers said he always entertained the possibility that he could be wrong about things. I don't want him to be wrong. But I know there can't be any dialogue or discussion if you're not willing to admit that or look at that possibility. I don't think it's an accident that that verse about seeing through a glass darkly is in the love chapter, preceded by a whole lot of verses that tell us in no uncertain terms that we're to love each other. It's gotten really easy for me not to spend a lot of time agonizing about what I don't understand. I think God's given us enough things that we do understand for it to take all our time to do those things. And these days, I like to describe it this way. I feel like a well-loved child who sometimes has to say, I don't know, but my dad or my mom does, and it'll be okay. And this all reminds me of when Dan Rather was talking to Mother Teresa and asked her, if God loved the people with whom she worked, why did so many of them die miserable and alone on the streets of Calcutta? Mother Teresa's answer was quick and to the point, as her answers always were. I don't know, but when I get to heaven, he's got a lot of explaining to do. Tony always said, that's why Mother Teresa lived so long. God kept saying, don't forget. I really don't understand why some people think they have to have all the answers first before they can do any good in this world or love anybody. And the people I've met who think they have all the answers, I think have a whole lot of wrong ones. And I'd rather have a few right answers and a lot of I don't knows. Tony and I both say that the older we get, the fewer things we believe, but the more strongly we believe those things we do believe. All of us us need to work to end the silence of the good people in the church. The world is hearing much from those who call themselves the church, but who speak neither good nor truth. As parents, now as everybody, we have to work to end the silence of the good people in the church. The world is hearing much from those who call themselves the church and say they speak for God, but who speak neither good nor truth. The opposite of love is not hate, but indifference or silence. Some of our best people and some of our best arguments for justice have to be in the closet. I don't ever ask that any gay person come out of the closet because I don't think I have that right. I have dear gay friends who are in the closet and equally dear gay friends who are out. I know of some good people who stay in the closet because they feel called to the ministry they've been given that they would lose tomorrow morning if they came out. And I don't think that I, as a straight person, have any right to tell any gay person to come out. But I do sometimes tell those who press me for an answer that I have yet to meet an out person who's sorry they came out. I'm sure someday I will. There have to be some. But I really have never talked to a person who was sorry they came out and wanted to go back and shut the closet door. I believe there are a lot of straight people in closets too, afraid to stand up for God's rainbow children, perhaps their own children. And I spend a lot of my time trying to get my straight brothers and sisters to take a public stand and demand both equal grace in churches and the equal application of the laws of this country for all God's children. It may be difficult for a straight person to come out as an ally, but not even half as hard as it is for a lesbian or gay man to come out. As a dear friend of mine once said to me, "Peggy, the difference is that they hate you for what you say, and they hate me for who I am. You could change what you say. I can't change who I am." So all you straight parents and friends, always remember that coming out is easier for you no matter how hard it is. I get really tired of listening to parents who are all wrapped up in their disappointment when they ought to be saying, "I know this is hard for you, but don't worry because we're with you, son." Or, "You're our daughter and we're there for you." Isn't that what parents are for, unconditional love? But sadly, only Jesus really practiced it. The rest of us try, and sometimes we don't do too well. I've met many very loving parents who want to stand up for their kids, but aren't sure exactly how to go about it. PFLAG is a great place to learn, but some parents need help to even be brave enough to go to PFLAG, so let me try to help a little bit here. First of all, it's important that we avoid confrontation for its own sake. What you need to do is be clever and find ways to mention homosexuality in ordinary conversation. Too many of the parents I meet have trouble getting the H word out of their mouths. It's like they turn green or their voices get funny when they say anything about that child of theirs who's different. And if they have so much trouble talking to me, whom they know is on their side, I can bet they hardly ever talk to anybody else. So my advice to them goes something like this. If you have three children and you're telling people about your family, it's so wrong and damaging for you to feel like you're keeping a dark secret every time you talk about just two of them. And it sure isn't nice for that third kid to always be left out when you tell people about your family. I suggest to those people that they stand in front of the mirror and practice saying something like this. "Our daughter Mary's in Cincinnati. Her husband Jack is a doctor. And they have two little girls, Mary Ann and Jacqueline. Our son Tom is in banking in New York. His partner Henry's a lawyer, and they're raising Henry's 12-year-old son. Michael, our youngest, Bill, is still at home. He goes to community college and wants to be a police officer." What did you notice? I didn't pause at the point where there's usually the, or what? You don't take a breath after you mention your gay or lesbian child. To do that's just inviting the gasp or the pitying look that always derails you. Go right on with the conversation, perhaps ending with, "What about your kids?" Maybe somebody will ask you how you feel about having a gay child, to which you reply, "I'm very proud of Tom." But more often than not, people won't say anything. And you'll think it didn't make any difference to be forthcoming about all your kids. Why would you do it? It was so hard for you and it didn't make any difference. But I know it's going to make a difference to you and how you feel inside that you didn't shut the reality of one of your kids out of the conversation. Second point, maybe that conversation is more important than you know. Maybe you'll mention your gay child to someone who will later, much later, find out that there's a rainbow child in their family. And maybe they'll remember that nice lady at church who was okay with her kid, or that deacon who had a gay child and didn't act like it was any problem at all. It's really, really important to start the conversation, to get out of the closet as a parent or friend of homosexual people or your homosexual child. When you start talking, others will join in. It always takes far more courage to be the first one. But after you get the courage and pray about it and do it, it will amaze you to see all the people that come out of the woodwork, and some of them sneak up to you so nobody else will see them. But if you've learned how to come out, you can help them come out. I'm sick about the conspiracy of silence that leaves some of God's most hurting children terribly misunderstood. It has to stop. I think sometimes we remain silent because we don't really know how to say things, as I said, and some of us need to practice with each other, to get together in groups or even talk to the mirror more often if your spouse won't be your sounding board. I assure you that when I started talking about this some 22 years ago, I had real problems talking about it. But I worked hard, and it gets now so it's almost easy. It becomes almost fun, because it isn't your problem anymore if the other person has a problem. In fact, you have to be careful lest you start enjoying watching other people have a problem, because that isn't the Christian thing to do, and I've been perilously close to that several times, a lot of times. I remember speaking at a conference for Mennonite parents of GLBT kids as one of the more wonderful times I've had in my ministry. Those folks reminded me of the people in the church of my childhood. They sang the old hymns, and they all carried great big Bibles. But the difference between them and some of the other Bible-toting people I meet nowadays is that those Mennonites really, I mean really, knew what was in the Bible. And what they read had led them to be staunch allies and advocates for their children. Their retreat is called Connecting Families, and it's truly wonderful. When the Mennonites decide to do something, they're not chicken about it. Whether it's their stand against war or the stand those folks took for their kids by coming out to that retreat. I did a parent seminar there too, like I'm doing now, and I remember so well the lovely woman who came up to me afterwards to share the story I'm passing on to you now. She told me about her four children, two sons and two daughters, with whom she always felt she had a great relationship. Three of the kids lived nearby with their families, but the other daughter, a lesbian, lived in another state with her partner. One day when the out-of-state partner was home for a visit, she said, "Mom, why don't you have my picture on the wall with the other kids?" The mother realized in an instant the sensitivity and deep emotional depths from which that question came. She thought quickly and replied, "Well, you never gave me a picture of you and Sue. The pictures on her dining room wall were the other three kids' wedding pictures." Very soon, that mother received an envelope containing a lovely 8x10 picture of her daughter and her partner of many years. The mother found a picture frame identical to the three already on the wall and put the picture there in the dining room with the other three. Then she told me about her nervousness about the next church committee meeting she had at her house after the hanging of that picture. She feared that the dining room ceiling might fall in or that a lightning bolt would strike the wall of pictures. But of course, no such thing happened. The committee members gathered around the dining room table. "Who's that?" somebody asked, pointing to the newest picture. "That's our daughter Esther. She and her partner Sue live in Boston," the mother replied. "She looks like you," said one woman. "Oh, I thought you just had three children," said another. Very quickly, the meeting began as usual, to the surprise and joy of that mother. She went on to tell me how good it felt to be no longer hiding one of her children and how easy it was to invite Esther and Sue to go along to church with the family the next time they visited. One thing I don't do anymore is suffer in silence when people tell homosexual jokes, and you shouldn't suffer in silence either. I usually reply very seriously with something like, "I don't understand why you think that's funny." And when they look at me funny, then I say, "No, I really want to know. Tell me why it's funny." Or sometimes I say, "I have many gay and lesbian Christian friends, and I don't really like your joke." One more story from that Mennonite conference. There was one lovely lady there who had come out of love for a beloved nephew who's gay. She told me sadly that she knew she could never speak out, as I was encouraging people to do, and asked me if it would be all right if she prayed a lot for her nephew and others like him, but never spoke out on their behalf. I replied, "It would be wonderful if you prayed a lot, but it would be so much better for you, let alone your nephew, if you could say something and get to the point where you could stand up for him." She looked so very sad as we parted. She was really a scared little lady. But 3 months later, she called me on the telephone, and in her soft voice, she confided, "I still haven't really spoken out, but you might like to know what I did do." Then she went on to tell me that she and her husband had had two couples from their church over for dinner, and one of the men, in an effort to be funny, had started saying things no one should say about homosexual people. That woman described for me, so I could feel it, how her frightened body felt, how badly she wanted to say something, how she knew she should, how she prayed for strength, and how, with all her efforts, no voice would come out of her mouth. Then she said to me, "I pushed my chair back from the table, and I got up and went into the living room. I just sat there feeling so terrible that I had not said anything. I sat there for a long, long time, and then I got up and I went back and I served dessert. The evening ended and our guests went home. I cried myself to sleep that night as I thought about my dear nephew and wondered why I could not speak out for him when I loved him so." Then she went on to tell me how the following evening, when she was waiting for her husband to come home from work, there had been a knock at the door. The man whose words had so upset her the night before had come to see her. "I know I made you feel terrible last night. You didn't know what to say to me, and I didn't know what to say back to you either. I shouldn't have said those things, and I just wanted you to know I'm sorry and to tell you I'm never going to say that stuff again." His words had given my caller the courage to tell her visitor all about the nephew she loved. "And he listened to me," she said. "He really listened to me. And I said what I was always afraid to say. I told him all about Peter." How often, when we do our best and it isn't enough, God helps us finish what we're supposed to do. This lapel pin that I always wear has given me many opportunities to speak out for God's rainbow children. And I confess that sometimes, in a way that I don't quite understand, it gives me courage when I need it. I seem to need concrete objects, real things around me, to keep up my courage and remind myself as well as others where I stand. Things like the little orange sign on my refrigerator that says, "Homosexuals are just as likely as heterosexuals to change." Or the big stuffed Mickey Mouse in my living room. Or the note on my phone that reads, "Say it." One of the ways that I tell other people I'm a safe place for those who happen not to be straight is to wear this pin. But I do wear it for myself, too. I've worn it every day for many years on everything from t-shirts to party dresses. Fact is, I have about 40 of them because I got tired of moving them around and getting back to my clothes. My pin combines the cross on which Jesus died with the pink triangle that Hitler made some homosexuals wear in the concentration camps. Both the triangle and the cross started out as symbols of shame, used by people to hurt and humiliate other people. Both are now symbols of pride. I believe that because of Jesus Christ, there are no outcasts, and wearing this pin is one way I declare that truth. Now, wearing the pin starts a lot of interesting conversations. I mean, here is one thing, but out in the rest of my life. Some people know what the triangle stands for, but not much about the cross, and I get to tell them about Jesus. And some people know all about the cross, but they don't know what the triangle is, and I get to tell them about your kids. Then there are the people like the little old church lady who asked me where she could get a cute cross like mine with a little pink thing on it. And then there are the people that know what the cross is and what the triangle is, but don't have a clue why they should be together, and I get to tell them the most of all. But contrary to what that little old lady said, crosses aren't ever cute. Crosses are just hard to carry. I welcome any opportunity I get to educate those who have no idea how gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people have suffered and still do suffer. But most important to me are the people who see my pin and know they can trust me to understand and love who they really are. I could talk for a week about the people I've met because I was wearing that pin, but the people who really knew everything about who I am and what I do but were afraid to say it, so they come up in their opening line is, tell me about your pin, knowing I'll get into it. I'm proud of the fact that I was the one who designed the pin and that the Association of Welcoming and Affirming Baptists, an organization I served for some years as a council member, sells them. I got one pin story I think you'll enjoy because it's a story about when I was last here at Connection and I did a parents workshop then because they let me pick my workshop and that's what I like to do. And when I was at that last Connection, I had told my life story and I had told about the life-changing evening when Tony and I were in the car with the husband and wife who were saying terrible things about homosexuals, and that was before I could speak out and how miserable I was because I didn't speak the truth to them. And I related how for me that night a cock had crowed and I was left with my guilt because I realized I had not only betrayed some of my dear friends, but I betrayed the Jesus who loved them. Well, at the end of my workshop for parents, a couple rushed up to see me. The husband said, Peggy, I'm ashamed of myself because I haven't had the courage to tell anybody about our lesbian daughter, even though I love her very much. I know I've hurt her because I've not acted proud of her when I've been with other people, and that's all going to change. I want to buy one of your pins. His wife stood beside him beaming proudly, and I knew without them telling me that she'd been light years ahead of where he was when it came to being an out parent. It was several weeks later when I got a letter from him. The day after my seminar had been a Sunday, and he related how, while getting dressed for church, he had noticed the pin on the dresser. He picked it up, then set it down, saying to his wife as he did so, you know, I really do want to stand up for our daughter and tell people I'm proud of her just like she is. But somehow, I don't think our church on a Sunday morning is the place to start. His wife had walked silently over to the bedroom window and looked out into the backyard where a flock of crows had landed. Then turning to him, she said, will you look at all those California roosters? Why do you suppose they're all going to crow in your yard? Needless to say, his letter to me concluded, I wore my pin to church and I've worn it every day since then. A big challenge we face in our efforts to make things better for those rainbow children we love is the bad language the church is using. I'm not talking about dirty words the kind teenagers use to shock their parents. I'm talking about the misuse of words, the kind of language which accidentally, or I think on purpose, plays fast and loose with the truth and keeps people from knowing the truth. I've always loved words, but I didn't know how or understand how important language was to the way people thought about things until recently. Now I realize how the words are used can shape our thinking. I confess to being a woman who at first laughed at the feminists who demanded inclusive language. I now understand the ways in which words control how we think, and I don't laugh anymore. My very liberated lawyer daughter probably still thinks I'm too comfortable with the old ways of talking about things, but I've come a long way. And when it comes to a hot issue like homosexuality, correct language is crucial. For instance, the phrase, the homosexual lifestyle without an S on the end of it, should never even exist. There are many homosexual lifestyles, just as there are many heterosexual lifestyles. A person's orientation, be it heterosexual or homosexual, is a given, not a choice. But there are many lifestyles from which both homosexuals and heterosexuals may choose. Celibacy, promiscuity, and a monogamous lifetime committed marriage, to name three. There is no one homosexual lifestyle any more than there is a heterosexual lifestyle. And when I said, some of you have heard, when I talk to college audiences, I always like to talk about Madonna and me and remind them that Madonna and I are both heterosexual women, but we do not share a heterosexual lifestyle that we both live. And then I point out that the only reason for that is because I can't sing. I hope that the bit of humor allows them to remember not to use the phrase homosexual lifestyle. And more than not using it yourself, when anybody uses it to, in a conversation with you, you don't get angry or upset. You ask them what they mean by that and say very seriously that you don't understand how they could say that, like which lifestyle do they mean, and do they think there's a lifestyle that all heterosexuals live. I think it really helps to remain serious and ask people a serious question in a kind voice rather than jumping all over their case. And a lot of really nice people, even people on our side of this, use that phrase because they don't understand what it does. But I think the people on the far right understand real much how that phrase is used, and I don't think it got into our vocabulary by accident. Another important point on this subject is to note that when people use the word homosexuality, they need to be clear about whether they mean a homosexual orientation or do they mean a certain kind of behavior. Believe it or not, some people have never considered that these are two different things. If you insist that people explain what they're talking about, that forces them to think and be clear to themselves as to exactly what they mean when they're talking. And this goes very much for pastors in the pulpit as well as for folks in private conversations. And I think there are a lot of pastors that aren't as bad as they seem but use some wrong language, and somebody needs to go and correct them. Now, there aren't as many straight parents here as I thought there would be. And as I say this, one reason I think that straight parents and allies need to go around and really challenge people is because that's one thing it's easier for them to do. Sometimes people listen to you more if, as somebody here said, you ain't got a dog in the fight. And that's something allies can do, make people realize that they're doing something not for any personal reason, but they're doing it because it's the right thing to do. And I love to explain that when people try to ask me what secret thing or relative I haven't talked about that has got me doing this. It's the right thing to do, and I just pray that more people start doing it. And it would just take a leader in some places and other people would join in. Now, another bad set of words or phrase is the homosexual agenda that the enemies of truth have let loose in the vocabulary of our nation to inflame and frighten people. They'd like us to think that there exists a master list of horrible demands signed by every child of God who doesn't happen to be straight. And I love what my friend Jim Wallace of the Sojourners community says when anyone mentions the homosexual agenda to him. "I've not seen it," says Jim seriously. "Here's my card. Would you please send me a copy?" I hope when the people look at the card, they remember that they better check out where this thing is. Another couple of words that should not be used the way they're being used by those who would hurt our children are special rights. What the homosexual community is asking for are not special rights, but only the rights that the rest of us take for granted. It's not a special right to ask that you not be fired from your job or be unable to get an apartment because you're homosexual. I remember well being at a men's meeting, just a gathering of mainline church people in Florida with the layman there, Christian layman, where my husband was the speaker, and somebody in the question and answer thing sensed that Tony wasn't really hating the right people like you should. And asked him what he thought about, you know, the fact that they all wanted special rights. And Tony gave the most beautiful, clear explanation back. He knows more of the politics and the laws than I do of what was being asked for in some states and why it wasn't special. And I will never forget that man saying, well, I didn't know that's how it was. I'm for them having all those rights. And it just took one person to explain away a bad set of words. And Tony does a lot of that. Heterosexual advocates, parents, and others have to raise these issues. Every oppressed group has always had to have enlightened advocates who are part of the oppressing group. Racial minorities had to have spokespersons who were part of the racial majority. Women needed and still do need enlightened men to espouse their cause. And gay people in the church must have the vocal support of straight church people. Don't be part of the good people who do nothing. They speak with their silence. It isn't possible to be neutral. If you don't speak up for your gay sons and lesbian daughters, you're working against them. As out parents and advocates, we need to study the Bible to equip ourselves to speak in and to the church about homosexuality. We need to know the clobber passages as well as they do. The people who use them against us know them well. Now, I would bet that close to 100% of you in the room have heard the clobber passages ad nauseum, so I will be brief. But I always feel like there could be somebody there who hasn't heard it. And if you haven't heard it, tell me, because I'll feel good. Most of us aren't going to learn Greek, but we need to be able to explain what we have come to believe about the six passages of Scripture routinely called the clobber passages and used to clobber people like our kids. Those verses are well named. How can you possibly make your case with anyone who calls the Bible their authority if you can't explain the clobber passages? When I started to talk about this, I made a pony to keep in my Bible. In my day, a pony was a paper with the answers on it that the student who wasn't prepared for the test would sneak into the room. And I've still got my pony. I'll show it to you later. I don't use it as much as I used to, but in a confrontational situation, I'm glad it's there. Robin Scroggs' book, Homosexuality in the New Testament, is a good place to start your special Bible study, as is the very fine pamphlet, The Bible is an Empty Closet, by our own Dr. Ralph Blair. That's available over at the Resource Place, and it's just a really neat thing to have. He gave me permission to Xerox it, and I have a couple of them in my purse all the time to give to people like the people who asked me about my pin. If I get into a conversation because of the pin, I can give a person a good biblical argument to take away with them. It doesn't mean we're going to agree. I wish I had a nickel for every person I've hugged and said, let's pray to disagree and keep thinking about what we told each other. But let me do a very quick overview of the clobber passages here. The Genesis passage that's used a lot is God created people in his own image. In the image of God, he created them male and female. This text celebrates God's deliberate and equal creation of persons who are male and persons who are female. Such a sense of equal creation wasn't typical in the ancient world. People who use this passage against homosexuality should note Paul's statement in Galatians 3:28, in which he emphasizes that there's now no theological significance to the heterosexual pair, male and female. And when people act like Adam and Eve had the only kind of viable marriage, I wonder, are they saying if you have a marriage and you don't have children, it's not a viable marriage? The Bible doesn't say anywhere that that's the case. Paul states the basic principle that if restrictions are found elsewhere, such as in Genesis, they are to be understood in relation to Galatians 3:28 in the New Testament and not vice versa. Genesis 19 and also 18 and 20, the story of Sodom, is another one of the clobber passages. Sodom is used as a symbol of evil in dozens of places in the Bible, but not in a single instance is the sin of the Sodomites specified as homosexuality. Listen to the prophet Ezekiel on the sin of Sodom, chapter 16. And you can get Dr. Blair's pamphlet so you don't have to take notes about any of what I'm saying. It's all there. As I live, says the Lord God, this was the sin of your sister city of Sodom. She and her suburbs had pride, excessive food, and prosperous ease, but did not help or encourage the poor and needy. They were arrogant, and this was abomination in my eyes." The abomination here seems to be to neglect the poor, which hits a whole lot more people than if we use it for gay people. Then in Matthew chapter 10, the men of Sodom tried to dominate the strangers at Lot's house by subjecting them to sexual abuse. "Such attempted gang rape is about humiliation and violence and has nothing to do with the lives of the same gender Christian couples I know, and I doubt if it applies to you or any of your kids either. Leviticus 18:22, "You shall not lie as with women. It is abomination." In the Bible, abomination is a technical cultic term for what is ritually unclean, such as mixed cloth, pork, and intercourse with menstruating women. It's not about moral or ethical issues. The Holiness Code talks about men lying as women with other men, and such mixing of sex roles was thought to be polluting. But both Jesus and Paul rejected all such ritual distinctions. My husband likes to point out that the clobber verses in Leviticus are near that verse that prohibits touching the skin of a dead pig, and making that an abomination would sure mess up the Super Bowl game. Now, many of you are wearing clothing made of more than one kind of cloth, like polyester and cotton or wool and silk, for example. You are condemned by the same code that people use to condemn homosexual people. Then in the New Testament, 1 Corinthians 6:9 and Timothy 1:10, there are two Greek words to consider. Malakoi in 1 Corinthians probably refers to effeminate call boys, and arsenikoitai in Timothy was probably a word coined by Paul, and it's difficult to translate because it isn't used in other places. Paul was probably thinking of pederasty, men having sex with young boys, when he wrote it, because this was prevalent at the time and in the place from which he wrote to Timothy. Romans 1 is the toughest of the clobber passages. It's the basis for the disagreement my husband and I have on the issue of gay marriage. Tony believes verses 26 and 27 forbid all same-gender eroticism. And I believe Romans 1 is talking about pagan rituals and sexual orgies that took place in the worship of the goddess Aphrodite. The homosexual acts referred to as unnatural were probably the unnatural acts of heterosexual people, and I just can't relate Romans 1 to the same gender couples at my church. No way. I've been accused of not taking the Bible seriously. But I don't think you can use the Bible to tell you about something the Bible doesn't talk about, no matter how seriously you take the Bible. I need to mention here that the evangelical community is increasingly choosing to use the Revised Standard Version, where what used to be translated as sexual perversion is now translated as homosexuality. Many scholars feel there's no justification for this. A friend of mine likes to point out that for a long time the word was translated as masturbation until some of the monks, for some reason not explained, felt led to retranslate it. You know, in that version of the Bible, there's also a place where a disciple is called by her name, Julia, in other Bibles, and they've translated this one so she becomes Junius, so they don't have it there. And when you start messing with the Bible to say what you want it to say, it gets pretty scary for those of us that think it's important. Now, it's important to know the politics of what's happening around the issue of homosexuality in your denomination, and each of you should be members of the advocacy group in your denomination. A very real and immediate challenge is that some denominations are drawing up resolutions that exclude, and some have even voted to disfellowship or kick out those churches that affirm homosexual people as full members. I am brokenhearted to say that my American Baptist denomination has done that, and some we are in associations, and some associations in California and a couple other places have disfellowshipped churches, but associations like the Philadelphia Association, where my church is, have each taken in one of these churches, so they're still in. But the bad guys are working on the rules, and we are starting to think that there is going to be a split. And I don't feel as bad about a split as some other people. I care about other things more than I care about being Baptist, even though I'm a lifelong American Baptist. And also, Baptist means that every person is supposed to have soul liberty, and we believe in the autonomy of the local church. And that's already all gone down south, and it's creeping up north too. And sometimes I pray that a lot of new churches will be started, and I remind some of the people who talk to me about struggling in churches that it's easier to give birth than raise the dead, so they have to think about maybe starting something. For many gay people and for their parents and friends, the biggest decision they face now regarding their churches is whether to stay in them or to leave them. It's not an easy decision. My friend Sue back there is doing wonderful work at a Methodist church that isn't openly affirming or on any special list, but they're moving because of a group of people that are there who've chosen to work and love that church and a good pastor. But if you're in a situation where you're just up against a brick wall, you may come to another decision. One father and mother I know were in tears as they told me of their lifelong love for both their denomination and the home church where both of them had grown up and where they'd been married. Their son and his partner, both social workers, lived in another city. But when they come home, we can't bring Eric and Gary to our church. They have to lie about everything, the mother said bitterly. As we talked, I discovered the fact that those concerned parents were so sure about what would happen in their church that they just never brought Eric and Gary to church. I strongly advocated that they do so and see what happened. The very presence of their coming, along with their supportive parents, might open some people's minds. At the very least, it would make it harder for wrong things to be said from the pulpit. Now, I knew those two young men. They were strong Christians who weren't going to be driven away from God by the wrong actions of any particular church. Some kids you might have to be careful taking to a place where they'd be hurt. But they were thrilled that Gary's folks was willing to stand publicly with them, and they went. What happened? The church did not become a welcoming and affirming church, but neither did anyone there do or say anything to drive away the gay couple or their parents. The parents continue to worship there, but they've also started a home church on Sunday afternoons and advertised it in places where God's rainbow children would be likely to see it and learn of the church where they'd be welcome. Gary's parents also made the difficult decision to divide their tithe, their giving, in half. Half to their old church and allocating the other half for Christian organizations that supported their son and others like him. The process they went through to find and check out possible places to give their money was both a learning and an eye-opening experience for them. What my friends did isn't a perfect solution, but in this imperfect world, few solutions are perfect. I do know that those parents, my friends, feel a whole lot better about themselves as parents, and that their son and his partner come home for a whole lot more weekends than they used to. Helping to make safe places to worship for those children of God who happen not to be straight is something every church ought to be doing. If you're part of a church where that is not the case, you ought to seriously reconsider putting all of your time and all of your money there. Too many people are just putting their tithes and offerings where they always put them. Or if they stop giving to a place, they just stop giving anywhere and keep the money for a better vacation. That's not what I'm talking about. I think it's quite appropriate here for me to suggest that you consider becoming a regular supporter of ECWR. As far as I know, this is the only place like this place. And I've heard over and over again this weekend the stories of those who say that ECWR literally saved their lives. It started at the Women's Connection, talking to women, and when the group of guys came in, person after person told me that. And as I reflect on it, ECWR is really the reason why I'm up here, because it was Ralph Blair who became well known for starting this group, and therefore I knew where he was and what he believed when I became a new Christian and had to straighten out what, and had to make right what I believed about the Bible, because I hadn't read the Bible much and I didn't understand it. And some of you might like to hear the story of how I chose my Bible. I was telling Sue the other night. I had a Bible I got when I was 9 years old, a King James Version, and I didn't read it, and I wasn't interested in it, but it still got old and tired, and I didn't want a King James especially. So when I became a Christian, one day I made what for me was a very important pilgrimage to the Christian bookstore, and I purposely didn't ask my husband or anybody else what version I should get, and I planned to spend a good part of the day there. And I had Ralph's pamphlet with the clobber passages in it. And I got down Bible after Bible, and I looked at all the clobber passages, and I picked the one that said the best things. Talk about picking a Bible to agree with you, but I have the Revised English Bible, and I like better where it is than where some other versions are. When we don't give our kids good church places to call their own homes, it shouldn't surprise us when they end up in bad places. And nobody's loyalty to any church should stand in the way of their trying to make a good place for their children. I'll tell you another story. I took an evangelist whose name you would know, who doesn't agree with me, but has been my friend for a long time, along with his wife. I took them to the Gay Film Festival in Philadelphia to see a film that had been done about the harm that Exodus and certain religious groups do to people. And I didn't think they would go, and to my utter amazement, they agreed to go. So we went downtown and were sitting in the theater when all of a sudden I saw some things that made me realize that the Gay Film Festival shows films in pairs. And the film I wanted them to see was the second film that day. And the first film was, So Help Me, about leather bars. And that film was shocking to me. And I've been thinking about homosexuality a lot more than this man ever had. So we get into the film, and it gets worse and worse. And I was wishing I could die. And this is real. The guy turned to me and said, in a tone that I thought and still think was very pious, Peggy, why did you bring me here to see this? And it was like God handed me the sentence. Zingo, which I wish happened to me all the time. That would be wonderful. But you see me shuffling my papers and you know it doesn't. But anyway, I said to him, because I think you need to see the places that the kids have left to go to after you've shut the church door. And he said, okay. So we watched that film in all its glory. And then the film I wanted him to see came on, and it was a film of closed doors. There, it was about three particular young people, and their parents were interviewed, their church was interviewed. One was Jewish, and the other two were Christian. And I haven't gone so far as to rent that leather bar film to use in my work, but it certainly looked all right. As parents, we care about our kids, and if anybody does some of the things I suggest, it'll be because they care about their kids, probably, at least for starters. But this thing, this evil exclusion, goes far beyond hurting our kids. As Christians, we have a mission to the rest of the church that goes far beyond bringing it to an acceptance of homosexual people. That's big, but the whole thing is bigger. The evils of exclusion and intolerance may be flowing toward homosexual people now, but it's a stream that's not going to be contained, and it spills out in other directions, and it backs up to stagnate within and bring spiritual death to those from whom it flows. We're standing against something very ugly, very evil, the power of sin, so don't let your focus ever get narrow. I have chosen, and you may choose, to work in one part of this thing we're trying to fix, but it's big. It's really big, and it affects everybody. Jesus said that the world would know we're Christians by our love, and I submit to you that there isn't any other way for people to know whose children we are. We have to be a loving people even when we disagree. In the words of a dear seminary professor friend of mine now in heaven, he used to tell this to the people who were going to be preachers, we have a story to tell, it's supremely worth telling, and love will find a way of telling it. Sisters and brothers, mothers and fathers, the time is now to pray and ask the Holy Spirit to show you what is your part in bringing the love of God and the justice of God, for they can't be separated, to your daughters and sons, and the light of God to a church that is sadly off the track right now and sitting there in the dark. Now, like Ralph Blair, I'm thrilled that Coretta Scott King has spoken out for the homosexual community. Ralph mentioned that one of her daughters publicly disowned her for doing this. But I can add to that story that I have marched for gay rights with the other daughter of Martin Luther King and Coretta Scott King. And I want to close with the paraphrase of some words spoken by Martin Luther King. In the end, it is not the words of those who call us fags and queers that we will remember, but the silence of our friends and pastors and our parents, which sometimes seem to us like the silence of God. Pray with me. God, help us not to be silent. God, tell us what to say. God, we want to love unconditionally as Jesus did. Show us how. In the name of Jesus, amen. Thank you. That most of you probably have, but if you don't get it, and Ralph doesn't mind if you copy it, like I don't mind if any of my stuff is copied, we just want to get the message out there. And I also have some pamphlets here. I don't have a whole lot of them, so if you already have one, don't take one. But what it is the questions I most often get asked when I speak. And it's on legal size paper, and I'm very happy if you want to Xerox it. My address is on the back if you want to write to me. Let me just read you the very last question. Some of them are long. One question I get a lot is, if homosexual people raise kids, aren't those kids likely to turn out to be homosexual? Answer, probably not, since most of the homosexual people I know had heterosexual parents. And it's sharing time, and one thing neat about a small group is it feels better to talk back and forth, and I'm as interested in hearing anything that I didn't say that's occurred to you as I am hearing your comments or questions to me. You know, I just told you everything, so you don't have any more questions. How many people here are parents of gay kids? Okay, couple, good.
I have a question about, I've been thinking about this for very long, so I'm not really sure how to word it, but in the area that we live, mm-hmm. there are a lot of churches mm-hmm. that quote-unquote claim mm-hmm. to be open and affirming, but we've been to some of those church mm-hmm. services, and there is nothing that would let me know that they are. Not yeah. one single thing.
We had that at our church, too. We were wonderfully welcoming and affirming. You might hear the sermon preached by a lesbian or a gay person, but we still didn't have anything said. And we've done a couple things about it. Of course, it's hard to go in as an outsider. Well, you can go in as an outsider and point out that there's no way you know. And you often get the answer, well, we don't say we welcome poor people or divorced people or anything like that. And my answer to that is easy. I just say all of those people know they are welcome, because you never hear on Christian radio people railing against making them welcome. But this is a special case, and you need to do something different, because people who call themselves the church, who call themselves Jesus people, are saying lies. And I know, I say I know some people that have been kicked in the teeth by church so many times that they are not about to walk in 10 doors and find out where they're accepted. They will come in if they know absolutely they will be welcome. So we have a little tiny rainbow in the shape of a triangle. I mean, it's not huge, but it's big enough to see on the glass at the front door of our church. And I pushed this through just a couple months ago. We weren't advertising in the paper at all. Liberal churches can get a little snotty and think everybody should be able to find them, and they're so welcoming of everybody. And we now have an ad that I wrote the words for in the paper, and it says, because of Jesus Christ, we welcome diversity, I don't have it with me, but and affirm everyone. And that diversity word's a code word. It's a good code word. But I'm trying to, myself and some other people, write some articles for the newspaper that won't set wave the flag and say, yay, we have gay people, but it will mention a certain committee and say that it met at the home of Bob Johnson and Tim Stevens, and things like that. But you are so right. And sometimes the people at a church like that don't talk about it enough. Yeah, I don't want to push my pins all the time, but especially the straight allies. Sometimes I think gay people might consider that they're carrying enough crosses, they don't even need a little one on their lapel. So this was supposed to be for parents and allies. But you need to find ways for churches, just like individuals, to say where you are. And I get asked the question everybody does, what do? I mean, I'm at some party or church with Tony, and they say, what do? And I've had so many chances to do it that I've worked really hard on my answer. And it differs sometimes from place to place, because I want to pull people in, not turn them away. And if I'm with very fundamental people who I'm sure wouldn't agree with me, I said, oh, I have a job I love. I have a ministry that tells some people that don't think Jesus loves them that Jesus does. And they get all excited about that. And then I say, the group I talk to are the people who aren't straight, because some churches have made them feel like they're not wanted at the church, so therefore they think that God doesn't want them either, and I think Jesus wants me to correct that. And they have a powerful little to argue with. Yeah. And then, of course, I like the parties I go to where I can say, I'm a gay rights activist, and get a conversation. But you have to be careful how you say it. But, I think if you know anybody at those churches and could find a way to ask a very gentle question, perhaps with a story, you know enough people that you have stories, with a story of a particular person who needs to find a church and they're scared. Yeah, thanks for the question. You speak enough so you know how bad you need that first question. Yeah. Any other thoughts?
You have one, I can tell.
You said that your husband believes that being gay is not a choice.
Yes.
But yet he believes that homosexual behavior is a sin.
So don't use that phrase, homosexual behavior. Say what you mean, because there's a big sweep there. And if you say homosexual behavior in some circles, people picture wild bathhouses and things. You have to say what you mean. And I think what you mean is that he would not be for a lovely Christian monogamous marriage between two gay people. I'm glad you said that so I could show what I mean about not using the right words. I am not going to clearly explain and stick up for my husband's position because I argue against it three meals a day when he's home. People feel to me and me as the left and right of the issue, and that makes me laugh because to me the left is somewhere over in the more racy articles and Advocate, and the right is over with Jerry Falwell, and I'm not with Advocate, even though I like the magazine and read it sometimes, but I'm not there as much as I'm an evangelical speaking what I say, and Tony is certainly not Jerry Falwell or Pat Robertson, and if he was, I would be divorced. The reason Tony is so very different from those guys and from a lot of people who are not where I am is that Tony believes that he sees that in the Bible, and that's what he would say if any of you came to him for counseling. But he points out that sometimes people's marriages don't work, and people are divorced, and they remarry, and the Bible doesn't have good things to say about that, but we at the church have learned that there's this thing called grace, which we all need. Even if we're single, we need grace. And Tony believes very much that he doesn't have the right to make everybody do what he does. And when Tony visited a little church that I had a very small part in starting down in Arkansas, the pastor is a very good friend of mine, and we went down there and had dinner with the pastor and his spouse on Saturday night. And I mean, Tony is completely cool with other people not agreeing with him. And he also thinks, I argue with him about this, he says it's not a major issue. He means it isn't a major issue the church should be fighting about. And I'm telling him it's a real major issue to somebody that wants a wedding and isn't having one, and their church isn't arguing with the government for them. But Tony and I have come to almost perfect agreement on the issue of gay marriage, and we both believe the United States should do what they do in Europe. And any two people who want to get married, a man and a woman, two men or two women, should be able to go down to the courthouse and get a civil license, which would give them every single right everybody else has, exactly the same. And then the married couples and the straight couples, if they chose, would go to their house of worship and have a marriage, a wedding, and the government doesn't get the right to say who can marry or have a wedding. They just give out equal civil rights. And there are countries in Europe, Italy's one of them, where they do this. And that's wonderful, because if you're a gay couple, your church home is not going to be a church that says you can't get married, so you can get married in your church. And I really like that. And Tony, as a minister who marries people, says he doesn't like the way it is even for straight people. He said he's doing a wedding with the Bible verses and prayer and feeling like he's really a representative of Jesus up front. And then at some point he has to say, and now by the power given to me by the state of New Jersey or Pennsylvania. So I'm really happy that with all our back and forth, Tony and I were able to come to a conclusion that we both think is fair and better than how things are now.
So. Wasn't there a time in history when it was actually illegal to have a marriage ceremony in a church?
Oh, I don't know. That sounds interesting. It had to be state.
It had to be a state. It wasn't even legal to have it in the church. That was before the first century, or, you know, before the year 1000.
I never do a question and answer thing without going home with a list of questions to look up, right?
I just want to add what you were saying about you and Tony.
Yes, he knows us for a long time.
That Tony was such a help to me in my coming out process. And even though these differences of opinions, that never entered into my feeling totally accepted and totally loved. And of course, he eventually added to that, but you're going to really love Peggy when you meet her. And of course, I learned quite a few years ago that was the case. And but he was a tremendous help when I was feeling some persecution from some fundamentalist type ministers. And Peggy, I think, used to say, I guess she still say, well, I'm praying for Tony to change his opinion. And I have said that, well, I'm not, because he gets into some places to say some some things that we...
And he takes me with him. He wouldn't have me by myself.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know.
Of course. He's also getting more and more chefs now, but he still gets in some places.
I feel like he is so intelligent on most other things. I just think he's a Neanderthal on this, and I can't... It's very hard to live with. And the only way I can make rational sense out of it is that for some reason God wants him in
that
place.
That's what I
believe. But thank you for that, because of course I'd say he's a good guy. Thanks for saying it. Yes.
Does Tony have the ear of the current president in any way?
Tony met the current president when Tony said the benediction at Clinton's, the dedication of the Clinton Library that day. It rained, and Tony met George Bush because after they came in off the platform just drenched. I mean, most people had to throw their shoes away that they wore that day. And they wanted to put the canopy up for the dignitaries, and Bill Clinton, being Bill Clinton, said, if everybody's going to get wet, I'm going to get wet too. So there were kings and queens out there getting made fun. But anyway, Teddy came in with the VIPs out of the platform, and he felt somebody wiping the water off his shoulders and wiped off his head with their handkerchief, and it was George Bush. You know, Tony never wanted to be an advisor to presidents, and because of some things that they both cared passionately about, like poor people, he was already Bill Clinton's friend when Bill Clinton got into terrible trouble, and he still goes to see Bill Clinton occasionally and talks on the phone. And I'm really proud of him because he doesn't tell people what they talk about. And my husband loves to drop names, and it must kill him sometimes to not be able to do that. But he has really kept that man's confidence. And he felt like some people have offered to connect him to George Bush, but there wouldn't be as good a connection for a lot of reasons. And so no, but he's still friends with the other one. Yeah. Yes.
I just wanted to let you know what you personally mean to me, because I have been, I'm in a major industry of things, chief executive, very public. Part of my life has to be careful, though I've come out again. And I can hear people say it's okay that are gay. I can even hear Ralph say it when he's gay.
I know.
But for you, a straight woman who is recognized in the nation as an important person in the Christian world, to say it's okay, and these are the reasons why I know it's okay, and that means a lot to
me.
That affirms me more than any of the gay leaders. I say, well, they're gay, they have to say that, or I have to confirm them, but you have to say
well,
that.
If your job is to be a gay leader, it's a no-brainer that you're out of the closet and it isn't hard.
Right, but you don't have to.
Yeah.
And the gentle things that your husband has said over the years that I've read, I've always had a fondness for him, because I know that in his heart he's for us, but you have come out strongly, and your words mean a lot to me, because it makes me I believe what you say, and it makes me feel complete.
Well, thank you very much, and I'm happy to hear that you're where you are. You sound comfortable with yourself, and if other people aren't comfortable with how you're being led to do it, you sound strong enough to still do it your way.
Especially when you take David Myers. And that yours.
Yeah. I would never, I'm not an intellectual, and I could never see myself doing statistics. And when I got that book, I could have cried with joy, all the work that he and Letha did. And one of my big joys this conference is that I got to meet him. He's really a powerful voice. And as I said, I'm an optimist, but sometimes when people ask me where I see the whole gay movement going, I see, as well as you do, the awful walls being raised and ugly things being said and laws being passed. And I believe that that is the last gasp a really terrified side that sees where we're going. I mean, if nothing else, Teddy said on television, the program we were both on, he said, I know Peggy's side's going to win. and he didn't say that to make his wife feel good. He's a pretty good politician. And young people don't even have to get over anything and then see that gay people are all right. It's kind of like the young people now don't have anything to think about with the black-white thing. Little kids would come home from school and say, could somebody come home to play? And when I go pick them up, they would be black or Chinese, and I would say, you didn't tell me, and they'd look at me like, oh yeah, I guess he is black. And kids are getting that way about the gay thing too, and it's really neat. Yes?
Yeah, this is something that just occurred to me. When we went on our journey of discovery after Anna took her life, what mattered to me the most was the opinion of straight people like you, and Loose Means, and Ryder, and Daniel Helminiak. Those were the people. Yeah, people like that were the ones that I kept going back to. I kept going back to these straight people that had come on this journey. And so those of you, I guess I would just say those of you here that have gay family members, maybe trying to get them in touch with some straight people.
Okay, that's a good idea.
That direction, that was what did it for me. Mm-hmm. I kept going back to the straight people that had gone through.
Thank you for that, because I'm well aware that I need to get struggling gay people in touch with somebody further down that journey. And Roberta Kreider's three wonderful books have helped amazingly there. I mean, I get things to deal with that aren't part of my experience. And I said that Pastor Randy McCain helps me, but so also do some of the people who wrote chapters in that book. But I hadn't quite thought about the need for a struggling straight parent to connect with a straight person. Well, that's what you're doing. You're further down that road, and people can be in touch. You know, I have fun conversations with somebody like Cynthia Clawson, because she feels, you can tell, she feels as passionately as I do about this. She sings it and I talk it. But you can't quite figure out how God picks something so interesting and nice for you to do. Has come to something like this. And we were saying when we were together this morning that the more we say we get, more than we give, the more spiritual people think we are, but it's really true.
Another example is that I responded to was Phil Yancey's affirmation of his friendship with Mel.
Oh, Philip Yancey is a powerful person in a high place and a hard place. Tuck Phil Yancey in your prayers. He's one of my favorite people.
And an endorsement on the back of my book.
Oh, really? Oh, that's right. I forgot that. Yeah. Oh, and speaking of endorsements, there was a book mentioned here. I just want to make sure you all know to get it, called A Time to Embrace. David Myers mentioned it. It's going to be coming out. And yeah, that's another optimistic thing, all the good literature that's coming out by respected presses. Loie, you had a question.
I wanted to thank you once again.
Oh, you're so sweet. You thank me all the time. She writes me notes that if anything's going really bad, I get a Loie note.
Well, it's been wonderful to have you as an advocate. And coming up is an ongoing process of educating, especially the staunch religious right. Mm-hmm. And I've worked many years in evangelical churches, and I love invoking the Campolo name. And it's really an encouragement, mm-hmm. and I thank all of you parents, because it's important. The straight evangelical groups will listen to you, parents. They don't often, and they don't want to listen to the gay people, but they will listen to you, and they'll say, maybe they do have something that we don't know about that we should just stop and listen. And so I'm thankful to have you as a part of our allies and advocates to refer to. God always works in paradoxical ways.
Oh, you know.
And I'm thankful that you and Tony have your dialogue, because it's a teaching tool.
People buy it and take it to their mothers, and their mother says, Tony's pretty good, but look out for me. But they're already way ahead of Jerry Falwell by saying that. And James Dobson, who is the one I fear most.
Yeah.
And I fear James Dobson because his group says many wonderful things that I agree with. And if you're going to put out a bowl of poison, like some of the evangelists do, smart people stay away from it. But if you put out a beautiful platter of lovely fruit and a couple poison pieces in the middle, they don't see it. Yeah. Do you have a question?
Yes, I just a statement. I really believe that God has you and Tony in that dialogue, because the Christian world desperately needs models of dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know how to dialogue with people who differ from us. And in fact, I've taken the freedom of calling it the Tony Peggy dialogue principle.
Well, that's sweet.
If I come to a person that has a difference of opinion, as you mentioned, with the willingness to learn, I will.
Well, I'm just thrilled that that dialogue's on a couple places on the internet. I am a computer nerd. I can't do anything but email badly. And I was up most of the night last night copying something that I wanted to bring with me that my computer either ate or blacked out or something the day before I left. And then I met all these computer geeks here that could have helped me. Where were they? But anyway, I am so thrilled that people are putting this Christian gay network, I'm so excited about, because the magazine Open Hands that used to publish a list of churches and was my Bible when somebody would ask me where they could go, folded up. But this is going to be even better, because it won't just list the name of the church. Those people plan to check out and investigate a little bit. So if I want a church with liturgy, or if I want a church that does gospel music, or if I want this emphasized in preaching, I can find one. But some more people have to think about starting churches. I'm not convinced anymore that the churches that are will open their doors and we'll all be there together. I see more a model like Open Door in Arkansas, where some people that are straight have been hurt in other ways with the church come in. And I can't put into words, someday I should try in an article, the benefits I think I get by being part of this community. This community is so different from the rest of the church in its honesty. When I was in my family group the other day, I suddenly looked around and said, you know, it would take any ladies' church group the next 80 years to get halfway to what we're talking about. And I thank God, and they were real problems of people we were talking about. And I think God has some special gifts for the whole body of the church that God has chosen to give through the gay community. You hold them, and I feel them when I come here and when I go to certain churches. But the church is not just shutting people that walk on two legs out. It's shutting a whole big thing you have. And I'm wondering if maybe what we are going to have to do to get it to more people is some people with the gifts who feel like they can't be pastors because nobody wants them need to find a place where there isn't a good church and start one, and be willing to clean houses or clerk at a grocery store to put food on the table while they're getting it started. That's what's happening in the churches that are against us, these right-wing churches that are growing up and getting so big. They get a charismatic person that goes in there and will work their tail off, and they attract other people that will, that work as volunteers. And you get a really wonderful church. People will come because it's wonderful, and then they discover it's mostly gay, but they've still got the best choir and a great preacher and all. And that's the way I think we're going to get together. And I would love to talk to anybody who wants to do that. Well, I think our time is gone. If some of you want to get to that meeting, if anybody still wants to talk, I'll stay here. But I know some of you have places to go.